Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you from all over the world. Today, no guest, but it's going to be an absolutely empowering program. Yes, we always begin with health and healing. We're going to talk about, are you as old as what you eat? Researchers learn how to rejuvenate the aging immune system. And then how this simple and humble pear is packed with phytonutrients providing antioxidant protection against several diseases. And then I'll also describe each pear and what makes it special. Then being overweight increases liver risk, and supplements found to improve the quality of life for female cancer survivors, and much more on health and healing. Then I'm going to see what I can fit in for the remainder of the program. I want to share with you a very important part of a debate at the Oxford Union. This is the oldest debating society in the world, and in my opinion, the best. We have nothing in America to compare with it. And you'll hear a professor at Oxford challenging the first four people that preceded him, all, I believe, most from Oxford, on why they are opposed to Islam and state their case that it is a religion of destruction, that it is nihilistic, that it is misogynist. They go through all the litany, including and specifically terrorism. Now, many of you have heard Glenn Beck, you've heard almost all of the conservative commentators in points agree with that. Maybe not all of it, but certainly a lot of it. And condemn those who have not stood up, who are Muslims, against the more radical Muslims. Listen to the response from this person. We have not heard this discussion in the United States. We need to. Then I will be sharing with you one of the most insightful commentaries I have heard on those who support Judaism and how it's being affected by the politics of extremism and extreme Zionism in Israel by Rabbi Michael Lerner from Tikkun. I don't know if we'll have time beyond that, but if we do, I will open up our phones for your input and comments. I have put on my website Rabbi Lerner's commentary. It is called Mourning for a Judaism Being Murdered by Israel. And having an enormous Jewish audience and a lot of Orthodox Jews who listen to this program, they, from my personal interaction, they are in alignment with this. So I want to share this because this is also not getting out. Neither of these two points of view are getting out. I believe they should be. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. I believe that we are as old as what we eat, drink, believe in the environment which we live. I believe it's not one single factor. And throughout my career, having not just studied in advanced degrees and doctorates and scholarships in anti-aging research, but most importantly, in the laboratory work I've done and the clinical experience I've had, I've seen that if you just change a person's diet, you'll definitely see some improvements. Not necessarily longevity, but improvements. I also believe that you should change all of the things that are out of balance, but not everything in our life is out of balance. So what doesn't work, you address. What does work and you're happy with and is helping you harmonize, you leave be. Just maintain it. And that's how it's that simple. The formula is not complicated. I've mentioned this many times. It took me a lot of testing in the laboratory to prove that I could extend the life of rats. And I did. compared to those equally matched rats from the same offspring that were treated normally. They were the downstairs rats, and I was on the upstairs, and my rats weren't in cages. They ran free. They weren't fed standard rat chow. They were given organic food, most of it raw, almost all of it sprouted grains. They were given organic juices every day. There was soft classical music played. There was constant interaction. I was sitting there. My desk was there. If you could imagine doing your work throughout an evening, because I worked in the evenings, and having rats all over the place, never once bitten, not in 30 years. And seeing the characteristics, what happens when you give rats challenges. The more challenge you give them, the more creative they become. And then passing that on to their offspring. I saw all that. So then I went around the world. I traveled everywhere, trying to learn how did people live longer lives. Now, in the United States, we're very formulistic. We want something that is linear. We want something 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Give me the steps, one at a time. And we don't see integrated disciplines. We do not have an interdisciplinary approach to life. It is very, well, it's like Immanuel Kant, the head above, the body below. They don't see it as one. So I began to see that if you have a perfect diet, flawless diet, and you take the right supplements, you've got about 20, around 20 points going on a scale of 1 to 100 for you. And then if you exercise really well, don't exceed your exercise capacity, but don't be lazy, you can add about 10 to 12 points on that. Then if you look at stress and you don't absorb yourself in someone else's dramas, I just see all these drama people living like they're Greek tragedies, and they're so good at it that they play this game of trying to get you to rescue them, and they'll kind of faint in your direction. So you think that they're, oh, good, they're using my advice. They don't. That's the game. They'll take from you as much as they can. They're like a parasite. They're an emotional parasite because they have no sense of their own spirituality. They may be religious. They're not spiritual. And boy, is there a difference. But they see everything as an impossibility. And they plead their emotions through their story of woe. And in our country, we have a lot of men and women who, once impacted by these people, part of their natural inclination is, I can help this person. No, you can't. But you have to learn that lesson. I've had to learn that lesson. I've been a magnet for dysfunction. I don't think there's a person ever alive that's had more dysfunctional people in their lives than I have. And I haven't been able to help one, not one. I'm just honest about it. I wished I had. At times I thought I had. But at the end of the day, when you see them, they're right back to where they started, kind of smiling, saying, gotcha, sucker. All that you did, I played you. I've been played. You've been played. We all know it. Then more often than not, you're living in a stressful environment because they thrive on stress. Man, they love it. They love to triangulate. They love to gossip. They love to malign. They love to blame. They're good at blaming. What they're not good at is living an authentic life. And that's part of the reason that they're angry and jealous of people who have authentic lives. Do you ever notice how many people in this world are angry at you if you're happy, genuinely happy, if you're kind, if you're giving? Because they're not. They're selfish. They're self-absorbed. So when you add that into the equation, that's a big part of the equation. That's more important than diet and supplements and exercise combined. That's my research. That's my findings. Whether I wanted to find it or not, I had to be objective. And living a non-stress life in the midst of stress is one of the arts that we master, where we don't become absorbed by other people. We can help them or try or situations or environments, but we don't become a part of it. That's an old Buddhist concept of detachment. And then the final thing, and this is the biggest single percentage, this is at least 40% on a scale of 1 to 100, 40% of living a long, healthy life. The value of your belief system. What do you believe in? Is it something healthy, wholesome? Does it allow you to be an adventurer, to explore? In that kind of life, you don't look at mistakes as limitations. You look at them as lessons. Every mistake is a lesson to be learned. You're not afraid of your weaknesses. You're not afraid of what doesn't work because you want it to work, so you work on it. When I traveled around the world, the longest-lived people were the happiest. The shortest-lived people were the most stressed. I've seen some of the most toxic people in the world walk into a health food store. I've seen the most anal, uptight people at vegetarian conferences. That's why I don't go anymore. In fact, I was invited to be a keynote speaker at a vegan conference, and I declined. Because I don't want to be around militant, self-righteous people who believe that they're better than anyone else because they don't eat animal flesh. You're not better. You may be more aware, but it doesn't make you better. Because we have to realize that, friend, listen up. This is how it works. And this is especially true to Justice and Unity and all the dysfunctional people on the local station boards of Pacifica's management. To everyone out there, please do not be critical of people unless you are perfect. If you're not perfect, stuff it. All right? Because I think we've had plenty of that. And that's why food police and self-righteous people, to me, they're cultish. So when I look at a study like the University of College London, where they said that there's an interplay between nutrition, metabolism, and immunity, and it's involved in the process of aging, they are right. There's two studies that support this. Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council did a study, and they found that as you eat, you either construct your immune system positively or you destruct it. And that's how it works. But I would also say that's true of all the other things I mentioned. And so don't become so focused on nutrition or supplements you forget about everything else that matters even more. Because then when you put it all together, then you'll see the difference. This was published in Nature Immunology, and the study also suggested the function of old T lymphocytes could be reconstituted by blocking one of several molecules involved in the process. Now, for people with AIDS-defining illnesses, one of the things that we used to do, and I still do with the people I counsel, is I give them every possible input, including meditation, prayer, energy exchange with nature and animals, detoxification, living food diet, laughing, seeing comedies, being creative. All of those are part of a protocol, and lo and behold, they increase the T cells. Drugs? No, that's not the approach. Living a happy life? You bet it is. Now to the humble pear. Most people don't realize when they eat a pear what's in it. What really makes the pear powerful, especially for diabetics, who generally don't eat pears, but they should because the research shows that the flavanols and the flavan-3-ols and the anthocyanins and the special acids, you have unique acids in pears. These are key part of the phytonutrients. You have what are called hydroxybenzoic acids, like chlorogenic acid and gingisic acid and stringisic acid and vanillic acid and the hydroxycinnamatic acids, cormeric acid, furic acid. These are all very powerful in your body. This is what helps in the healing process. So, if you want to decrease the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease, pears, the fiber in the pear, the phytochemicals in the pear, all help in that process. Now, you've got a lot of different pears, and they're all good. Bartlett pear, that's probably the most popular in the United States. And Bosque pear, my favorite's the Comus pear, because it's really juicy. And Concordia, the green Anjou, the red Anjou, they are all good. So have a pear. Make sure it's organic. Being overweight increases your liver risk. That's based upon the latest studies. And from the Journal of Gastroenterology, they found that when you're overweight, just for any reason, it doesn't matter, you're raising the level of your triglycerides. Now, that's a kind of a blood fat, and when it's elevated, you increase the risk of developing cirrhosis of the liver, even if you don't drink. Quote from the study, a liver that has been ill and weakened as a result of overweight can take less of a load. We can therefore speculate that cirrhosis of the liver will develop more quickly in people who drink if they are overweight. So, lose the weight and don't drink. And finally, if you are a woman who has survived breast cancer, according to Wake Forest University, as published in the American Society of Clinical Oncology, natural nutritional supplements will be an important benefit to you and allow you to live a longer life. And we've been saying that for a long time, but it's good to see that they've caught up and are now offering the suggestions we offer. They're not using the full spectrum like the green tea, coenzyme Q10, curcuminoids, but they're at least at the basics like vitamin E and vitamin C and ginseng, ginkgo, L-arginine, and other minerals for good health. So a good study proving it makes a difference to take your supplements if you have breast cancer. Well, then the question is, why wouldn't it also make sense to take your supplements for any kind of cancer and even to prevent cancer? Well, of course, the answer is it does. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment for our commentary segment of the program. Please stay with us.
And if I had someone to love me.
We're going to approach the topic of Israel and Zionism and Judaism from a highly respected scholar and rabbi, Michael Lerner, to give us a perspective that is missing in the mainstream American media. We are also going to have a look at Islam from a person who is in a debate, and the debate has concluded with the four people against Islam, and you would have thought that they were talking based upon what conservative radio hosts have to say about Islam. But it's important we hear the debate. Then you make up your mind for yourself. I want to start with Rabbi Michael Lerner. His missive is entitled, Mourning for a Judaism Being Murdered by Israel. It is posted on blog.garynall.com. If you forget that, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com and all of our articles every day are posted, and we will have posted within the next couple of days the filmed interview of the survivor of the 9/11 who took photographs at the scene that have never been seen before, and tomorrow they are being turned over to the architects and engineers for 9/11. Some 2,500 members will analyze them forensically to see which pieces of the puzzle they put together. I watched them, I looked at them, and they're in the film and they're explained in detail. It'll be posted shortly. Quote, my heart is broken as I witness the suffering of the Palestinian people and the seeming indifference of Israelis. We are marking the Jewish commemoration of disasters that happened to us through Jewish history. I'm going to be fasting and mourning also for Judaism being murdered by Israel. No matter who gets blamed for the breakdowns and ceasefires, or for starting this latest iteration of a struggle that is at least 140 years old, one of the primary victims of the war between Israel and Hamas is the compassionate and love-oriented Judaism that has held together for several thousand years. Even as Israel withdraws its troops from Gaza, leaving behind immense devastation, over 2,100 dead Gazians and over 4,000 wounded, without adequate medical supplies because of Israel's continuing blockade, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu refuses to negotiate it. He is fearful that he will be seen as weak if Israel gives away to Gazians' demands for an end to the blockade and the freedom of thousands of Palestinian prisoners kidnapped and held in Israeli jails in violation of their human rights. Let me explain why Israel's behavior towards Palestinians, not just during this latest assault, but also throughout the past decades, during which Israel militarily enforced its occupation of the West Bank and the blockade of food and building materials to Gaza, and the cheerleading for such behavior by Jews around the world, is destroying Judaism and creating a new kind of hatred of Jews by people who never before had any issue with Jews, not to mention strengthening the hands of the already existing anti-Semites, whose hatred of Jews would continue no matter what Israel or Jews do or do not do. All of my life I've been a champion of Israel, proud of its many accomplishments in science, technology, that have benefited the world, insistent on the continuing need for the Jewish people to have a state that offers protections from anti-Semitism that has reared its head continuously throughout Christian and Islamic societies, and enjoying the pleasures of long swaths of time in which I could study in Jerusalem and celebrate the religious holidays in a city that weekly closed down the hustle and bustle of the capitalist marketplace for full 25 hours. And although as editor of Tycoon, I printed articles challenging the official story of how Israel came to be, showing its role as forcibly ejecting tens of thousands of Palestinians in 1948 and allowing Jewish terrorist groups under the leadership of future Israeli prime ministers Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir to create justified fears that led hundreds of thousands of other Palestinians to flee for their lives. I've also been a severe critic of those who used criticisms of Israel as a cover for the anti-Semitism inherent in holding Jews to a higher standard than they held their own or other countries. I always told myself that the dominant humanity of the Jewish people and the compassionate strain within Torah would reassert itself once Israel felt secure. That belief that Israeli goodness would ultimately prevail began to wane in the past 8 years, when Israel ignored the Saudi Arabian-led peace initiative, refused to stop its expansion of settlements in the West Bank, and imposed an economically crushing blockade on Gaza. Israel did all this in spite of the fact that the Palestinian Authority had promoted nonviolence, actively cooperating with Israel's security forces to prevent any attacks on Israel, and seeking reconciliation and peace. The Saudi Arabian-led peace initiative, which Israel never even responded to, would have granted Israel the recognition it has long sought, ended the hostilities, and given Israel a recognized place in the Middle East. Though it had some imperfections, it was a generous first step toward a realistic peace accord with all the Arab states of the region. Even Hamas, whose hateful charter called for Israel's destruction, had decided to accept the reality of Israel's existence while unable to embrace its right to exist, nevertheless agreed to reconcile with the Palestinian Authority, and in that context live within the terms the Palestinian Authority would negotiate with Israel. Most Israelis ignored all this and were content to ignore the Palestinian suffering under occupation or the Gazians slowly being reduced to, well, to serfs from the Israelis' blockade. Without violence, Israelis turned their attention to becoming the Silicon Valley of the Middle East and electing a right-wing government that could charm Israel's American-based cheerleaders among Christian Zionists, the American Jewish community, and a super-compliant and fawning U.S. Congress, with each major political party competing with the other on which could be seen as most hawkish. Far from embracing the new felt possibility for peace that the reconciliation between Palestinian Authority and Hamas provided, after all, for years the Israeli government had downplayed the importance of negotiating with the Palestinian Authority precisely because a peace agreement with them would still have left Hamas to carry out its war plans, the Israeli government used that as its reason to completely break off the peace negotiations, and then, in an unbelievably cynical move, let the brutal and disgusting murder of three Israeli teens by a rogue element in Hamas that itself was trying to undermine the reconciliation with Israel factions by Hamas, by creating new fears in Israel, become the pretext for a wild assault on the West Bank civilians, arresting hundreds of Hamas sympathizers and escalating drone attacks on Hamas operatives inside Gaza. When Hamas responded by starting to send its missiles, which were rendered ineffective and hence mostly, though not entirely, symbolic by Israel's Iron Shield towards civilian targets in Israel, the Netanyahu government used that as its excuse to launch a brutal assault on Gaza. But it is the brutality of that assault which finally broke me into tears and heartbreak. While claiming that it is only interested in uprooting tunnels that could be used to attack Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces have engaged in the same criminal behavior that the world condemns in other struggles around the world. Massive killings of civilians, the same crime that Hamas has been engaged in over the years in its bombing of Israeli settlements, and thankfully, unsuccessfully, fairly much, which correctly has earned it the label as a terrorist organization, using the excuse that Hamas is using civilians as human shields and placing its war materials in civilian apartments, a claim that a UN Human Rights Investigative Commission found groundless when Israel used it the last time it invaded Gaza in 2008-9, and engaged in similar levels of killing civilians, Israel has managed to kill over 2,000 Palestinians and wound over 8,000 more. The stories that have emerged from eyewitness accounts of hundreds of children being killed by Israeli soldiers indiscriminate, the destructiveness, the shelling of UN schools and public hospitals, and finally the destruction of Gaza's water and electricity, thus guaranteeing deaths from typhoid and other diseases, as well as widespread hunger among the million and a half Gazians, most of whom had nothing to do with Hamas, highlights to the world an Israel that is rivaling some of the most oppressive and brutal regimes in the contemporary world. Israel does not intentionally target civilians, but it has full reason to know that its targets will inevitably kill huge numbers of civilians. We, who rejected the excuse that Viet Cong were hiding in Vietnamese villages as the rationale for U.S. forces to wipe out hundreds of such villages and ultimately cause millions of Vietnamese deaths in the Vietnam War, will not accept a similar rationale for what is de facto Israeli war on civilians, Palestinian civilians. Fine, destroy tunnels, not a problem, potentially used to infiltrate Israel, but it is a crime against humanity to destroy housing compounds, schools, and hospitals. In my book, Embracing Israel, Palestine, I argue that both Israelis and Palestinians are victims of post-traumatic stress disorder. I have a great deal of compassion for both peoples. Members of the Jewish people have been the victims of 1,600 years of oppression in European countries and hundreds of years of apartheid-like conditions in Muslim countries. We have faced a world that mostly refused to help us or open its doors to us as refugees when we were the victims of genocide. The traumas of that past still shape the consciousness of many Jews today. Jews deserve compassion and need healing. Similarly, the Palestinian people's expulsion from their homes in the process of the founding of the State of Israel, remembered as the great catastrophe, al-Nakba, continues to shape the consciousness of many Palestinians 66 years later. But those traumas don't exonerate Israel's behavior or that of Hamas, though they are relevant for those of us seeking a path to social healing and transformation. Yet that healing is impossible until those who are victims of post-traumatic stress disorder are willing to work on overcoming it. I have great compassion for the fears that Israelis have about Palestinians wiping them out, fears that have over the years been intensified by the Hamas charter calling for the wiping out of Israel and by the various Palestinian acts of terror against civilians. Unable to see that the occupation itself is an oppressive reality, that the arrest of thousands of Palestinians and then keeping them for months in administrative detention is perceived by Palestinians as ongoing kidnapping that has become a fact of life under occupation. Unable to see that Israel's restrictions on foods and medicines to Gaza through a blockade for the past 8 years has caused many deaths of civilians as another regular fact of life, and hence unable to see the various violent acts of resistance by Palestinians as morally equivalent to the way the Ergun and the Etzel engaged in terror against the British and against Palestinians in the lead-up to creating Israel. Most Israelis feel victimized and fearful. And who wouldn't, living for the past month in a situation in which the sirens sound many times a day and people are encouraged to take cover in shelters, though thankfully the Hamas bombs didn't get through the Iron Dome in most cases. All this is to say that one cannot approach these issues without insisting, as I did in a full way in my 2012 book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, that we have two traumatized people, and that those peoples have the suffering and fears of each must be acknowledged and given empathy if we are ever to transcend the current circumstances. To the extent that other parts of this essay seem to reflect special emphasis on Israel's sins, it is partly because Israel is the military stronger party and hence has the greater responsibility to show compassion, partly because the way Israel is destroying the reputation of the Jewish people in ways that will come to haunt us and our children and grandchildren for generations to come. And this is precisely where the American Jewish community and Jews around the world have taken a turn that is disastrous, turning the Israeli nation state into the Jewish state and making Israel into an idol to be worshipped rather than a political entity like any other political entity with strengths and deep flaws, a political entity which should be held to account for its systematic violations of human rights. Sadly, too many Jews relate to Israel not as a state, but as some holy reality, despairing the spiritual salvation after God failed to show up and save us from the Holocaust. Increasing numbers of Jews have abandoned the religion of compassion and identification with the most oppressed that has championed throughout history by our biblical prophets. Instead, they've come to worship power and rejoice in Israel's ability to become the most military, powerful state in the Middle East. If a Jew today goes into any synagogue in the United States or around the world and says, "I don't believe in God or Torah, and I don't follow the commandments," most will still welcome him or her and urge him to become involved. But if the same person says, "I don't support the state of Israel," she is likely to be labeled a self-hating Jew or an anti-Semite to be scorned and dismissed. As Aaron said of the golden calf in the desert, "These are your gods, O Israel." The adulterous view that God is working through the Israeli Defense Forces has led some Jews to believe that this powerful army is the most moral army on earth, and no amount of senseless killing of civilians breaks through this religious worship. The worship of the state makes it necessary for Jews to turn Judaism into an auxiliary of ultra-nationalistic blindness. Every act of the State of Israel against the Palestinian people is seen as sanctioned by God. Each Sabbath, Jews in synagogues around the world are offered prayers for the well-being of the State of Israel, but not for our Arab cousins. The very suggestion that we should be praying as well for the Palestinian people's welfare is seen as heresy and proof of being a self-hating Jew. The worship of power is precisely what Judaism came into being to challenge. We were the slaves, the powerless. And though the Torah talks of God using a strong arm to redeem the Israelites from Egyptian slavery, it simultaneously insists over and over again that when Jews go into their promised land in Canaan, and now Palestine, they must love the stranger, the other. Have only one law for the stranger and for the native-born, and warns, do not oppress the stranger, the other. Remember, Torah reminds us that you were strangers, the other in the land of Egypt, and you know the heart of the stranger. Later sources in Judaism even insist that a person without compassion who claims to be Jewish cannot be considered Jewish. A spirit of generosity is so integral to Torah consciousness that when Jews were told to let the land lie fallow once every 7 years, they must allow that which grows spontaneously from past plantings to be shared with the other, the stranger. The Jews are not unique in this. The basic reality is that most of the humanity has always heard a voice inside themselves telling them that the best path to security and safety is to love others and show generosity, and a counter voice that tells us that the only path to security is domination and control over others. This struggle between the voice of fear and the voice of love, the voice of domination and power over, and the voice of compassion and empathy and generosity have played out throughout history and shape contemporary political debates around the world. Almost every single one of us hears both voices. We are often torn between them, oscillating in our communal policies and our personal behavior between these two worldviews and ways of engaging others. As the competitive and me-first ethos of the capitalist marketplace has grown increasingly powerful and reflected in the culture and worldviews of the contemporary era, more and more people bring the worldview of fear and domination and manipulation of others into personal lives, teaching people the rationality of the marketplace with this injunction to see other human beings as primarily in terms of how they can serve their own needs, rather than as deserving care and respect just for who they are. This ethos has weakened friendships and created the instability in family life that the right has so effectively manipulated. I believe this. My years as a psychotherapist and a principal investigator at the National Institute of Mental Health and doing research in the psychodynamics of daily life in Western societies, every religious and secular worldview, including Marxism, feminism, liberalism, psychoanalysis, and the various ideologies that predominate in the universities hiding under the guise of pseudoscientism, has had partisans of both worldviews contending with each other. Because every religion and secular worldview reflects this conflict within the psyche of the human beings who have articulated them, no wonder that Jews and Judaism have had these conflicting streams within our religion as well. Those compilers of the Torah who heard God's voice commanding the Israelites to wipe out the inhabitants of the Promised Land in order to start afresh were explaining away some 2,000 years ago by subsequent interpreters who emphasized that those peoples referenced in Torah no longer existed, so the command to love the other was the only relevant guide for our lives as Jews. Yet subsequent generations, facing the frequent assaults on Jews by majority populations in the diaspora, found it hard to keep the command to love the stranger, the other. Even as those others were killing, raping, and robbing them, some sought to reinterpret the word stranger and other in a more tame way, saying that it only meant convert to Judaism, an interpretation that few in the face of the Torah statement, remember you were the Ger, the in the land of Egypt, the other. In the 2,000 years of relative powerlessness, when Jews were the oppressed minorities of the Western and Islamic societies, the validation of images of a powerful God who could fight for the oppressed Jews was a powerful psychological boon to offset the potential internalizing of the demonization that we face from the majority cultures. In the practice of demeaning the other while embracing a notion of Jews as a chosen by God, rather than responding with love to our oppressors, was arguably a brilliant psychological strategy for refusing to internalize the demeaning rhetoric of our oppressors and fall victim to self-hatred. But in this moment, when Jews enjoy military power in Israel, as well as economic and political power in the United States, and to some extent in many other Western societies, one would have expected that the theme of love and generosity, almost always a major voice even in a Jewish people that were being brutalized, would now emerge as the dominant theme of the Judaism of the 21st century. Trusting not in love and kindness and the possibility of transforming our world, but instead believing that we must always be on the defensive and rely not in trusting our fellow human beings, but relying on power, military might. This is the tragic victory of Hitler over the consciousness of the Jewish people, who are increasingly unwilling to continue to embrace the worldview of hope and possibility that Judaism originally emerged to affirm and popularize. No wonder, then, that I'm brokenhearted to see the Judaism of love and compassion being dismissed as unrealistic by so many of my fellow Jews and rabbis. Wasn't the central message of Torah that the world was ruled by a force that made possible the transformation from that which is to that which can and should be? It wasn't our task to teach the world that nothing is fixed, that even the mountains can skip like young rams and the seas can flee before the triumph of God's justice in the world? Instead of preaching this hopeful message, too many rabbis and rabbinical institutions are preaching a Judaism that places more hope in the might of the Israeli army than in the capacity of human beings, including Palestinians, to transform their perception of the other and overcome their fears. Even in the darkest days of our oppression, most Jewish thinkers believed that all human beings were created in the image of God and hence were capable of transformation to once again become embodiments of love and generosity. As the prayer for Yom Kippur says, till the day of their death, you, meaning God, wait for them, that perhaps they might return, and you will immediately receive them. In contrast, today's rabbis are more like the set of past-era Protestant theologians who used to emphasize human sinfulness as almost impossible to overcome and hence rejected any hope of social transformation. They scoff at the possibility which we in Tycoon magazine, in our network for spiritual progressives, have been preaching, not only for the Middle East, but for the United States as well, that if we act from a loving and generous place, seeking to overcome behaviors that were previously perceived as disrespectful and humiliating, that the icebergs of anger and hate, some of which our behavior helped to create, can melt away and people's hearts can once again turn toward love and justice for all. Our call for the United States to develop a good global Marshall Plan and a strategy of generosity towards the developing world, and for Israel to develop a Marshall Plan to rebuild Gaza and the West Bank so that it can easily accommodate the millions of Palestinians still stuck in refugee camps around the Arab world, get ignored because in both the United States and Israel, the belief in homeland security through domination leads people to dismiss the religious call in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism, as well in some secular humanist societies, for security through generosity and open-hearted reconciliation. I've applied these principles to develop a detailed plan for what a peaceful resolution of the conflict would look like in embracing Israel-Palestine. In an America which at this very moment has its president calling to send tens of thousands of child refugees back to the situations they risked their lives to escape, in an America which refused to provide Medicare for all, in an America which serves the interests of the richest 1% while largely ignoring the needs of its large working class and middle class, these ideas may sound naive, even utopian. But for Judaism, belief in God was precisely a belief that love and justice could and should prevail, and that our task is to embody that message in our communities and promote that message to the world. It is this love, compassion, justice, peace-oriented Judaism that the state of Israel is murdering. The worshippers of Israel have fallen into a deep cynicism about the possibility of a world that the prophets called for, in which nations shall not lift up the sword against each other, and they will no longer learn war, and everyone will live in peace. True, that world is not ready here, but the Jewish people's task was to teach people of this world and bring them into that being, and that each step we take is either a step towards that world or a step away from it. The Israeli worshipers are running away from this world of love, making it far less possible, and they call their behavior Judaism, and Israel the Jewish state. If Judaism's call for a world based on social justice, peace, and love for the other is dismissed as impossible under current conditions, the least we could ask for Israel is that it describe itself as a state with many Jews, rather than a Jewish state, since the latter implies some connection to Judaism and its prophetic tradition. No wonder, then, that I mourn for the Judaism of love, kindness, peace, and generosity that Israel worshippers dismiss as utopian fantasy. To my fellow Jews, I issue the following invitation. Use the traditional fast day mourning the destruction of Jewish life in the past, the next time it comes, to mourn for the Judaism of love and generosity that is being murdered by Israel and its worshippers around the world. The same kind of idol worshipping, pretending to be Jewish but actually assimilated into the world of power, helped destroy our previous two Jewish commonwealths and our temples of the past. I urge Jews who agree with the perspective to go to the high holidays throughout the year and publicly insist that the synagogue services include repentance for the sins of the Jewish people in giving blind support to immoral policies of the state of Israel. Don't sit quietly while the rabbis or others give talks implying that Israel is wholly righteous and the Palestinians are the equivalent of Hitler or some evil other. Pass out to the people of the High Holy Days For Our Sins workbook that Tycoon has developed and that is up on the website as of now. Write to your synagogue beforehand to ask them to include that list of sins among those that are traditionally read on Yom Kippur. That reading will be certain to generate a new aliveness in your synagogue and make Yom Kippur more spiritually real and deep than passively sitting through a service that is ignoring some of the central issues for which we should be atoning. Whether or not you go to synagogue or any of the high holidays, please donate time in the service of humanity. Please don't be silent when rabbis refuse to acknowledge their idol worship and their blind support for Israeli policies. Insist that they take into account, when judging Palestinians, the psychologically and ethically destructive impact of living under occupation. Ask them to choose between demanding that Israel immediately help the Palestinian people create their independent state without an occupying Israeli army, or demanding that Israel give all the Palestinians the same rights that Americans fought for in our revolution and that we demanded of Africans in South Africa and African Americans in the South. One person, one vote. In the Israeli Knesset elections, we may have to renew our Judaism by creating a liberatory, emancipatory, and transformative love-oriented Judaism outside the synagogues and traditional institutions, because inside the existing Jewish community, the best we can do is repeat what the Jewish exiles in Babylonia said in Psalms 137. How can we sing the songs of the transformative power in a strange land? And let us this year turn Yom Kippur into a time of repentance for the sins of our people who have given Israel a blank check and full permission to be brutal in the name of Judaism and the Jewish people, even as we celebrate those Jews with the courage to publicly critique Israel in a loving but stern way. Doing so does not mean obscuring the immorality of Hamas's behavior. But the High Holidays is meant as a time to focus on what our sins are, not the sins of others. It's time that we stop hiding behind the distortions in others to avoid our own distortions. For our non-Jewish allies, the following plea: do not let the organized Jewish community intimidate you with charges that any criticism of Israel's brutality towards the Palestinian people proves that they are anti-Semites. Stop allowing your very justified guilt at the history of oppression your ancestors enacted on Jews to be the reason you fail to speak out vigorously against the current immoral policies of the State of Israel. The way to become real friends of the Jewish people is to side with those Jews who are trying to get Israel back on track towards its higher values, knowing full well that there is no future for a Jewish state surrounded by 1 billion Muslims except through friendship and cooperation. The temporary alliance of brutal dictatorships in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and various Arab Emirates that give Israel support against Hamas will ultimately collapse. But the memory of humiliation at the hands of the State of Israel will not collapse, and Israel's current policies will endanger Jews both in the Middle East and around the world for many decades after the people of Israel have regained their senses. Real friends don't let their friends pursue a self-destructive path. So it's time for you, too, to speak up and to support those of us in the Jewish world who are champions of peace and justice, and who will not be silent in the face of the destruction of Judaism. One concrete step: join the Network for Spiritual Progressives and help us get the message I'm articulating into the public arena in the United States. With 57% of Americans supporting Israel's assault on Gaza, the most important task we have is to shift mass consciousness towards a more nuanced position that is both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine. And on the other hand, to our non-Jewish friends, please don't be angry at all Jews for the distorted behavior of a state that calls itself the Jewish state and that acts in an arrogant, provocative, and disrespectful way, making itself the neighborhood bully of the Middle East. That state did not consult most Jews about its policies. And please recognize that the anti-Semitic outbreaks that we've seen recently in France, Belgium, and other European countries are no different than other kinds of racism, blaming all people of a particular group for evil behavior of some. And that gets me to my last point. Younger Jews, like many of their non-Jewish peers, are becoming increasingly alienated from Israel and from the Judaism that too many Jews claim to be the foundation of the supposedly Jewish state. They see Israel as what Judaism is in practice, not knowing how very opposite its policies are to the traditional worldviews most Jews have embraced throughout the years. It is these coming generations of young people whose parents claim to be Jewish but celebrate the power of the current state of Israel and never bother to critique it when it is acting immorally, as it is today in Gaza, who will leave Judaism in droves, making it all the more the province of the Israel worshippers, with their persistent denial of the God of love and justice and their embrace of the God of vengeance and hate. I won't blame them for that choice, but I wish they knew that there is a different strand of Judaism that has been the major strand for much of Jewish history, and that it needs these active engagements in order to reestablish it as the 21st century continuation of the Jewish tradition. That I have to go to non-Jewish sources to seek to have this message circulated is a further testimony of how much I mourn over the dying of the body of the Judaism of love, pleading for Jews who privately feel the way I do to come out of their closets and help us to rebuild the Jewish world in which tycoon becomes an agenda. Above all else, I grieve for all the unnecessary suffering on this planet, including the Israeli victims of terrorism, the Palestinian victims of Israeli terror and repression, and the victims of America's misguided wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and the victims of America's apparently endless war on terrorism, the victims of so many other struggles around the world, and the less visible but real victims of a global capitalist order in which, according to the UN, between 8,000 and 10,000 children under the age of 5 die every 24 hours from malnutrition or diseases related to malnutrition. And yet I affirm that there is still the possibility of a different kind of world if only enough of us would believe it, and then work together to create it. End quote. Rabbi Michael Lerner. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I had an article sent to me from about four or five of your listeners from around the country, and it was an article that was about Jim Foley, the gentleman that was beheaded by the ISIS group. And I think that the thing about the article was that people are starting to speak out against the fact that the government really didn't handle this at all. And, you know, it says this gentleman was sacrificed simply because of a lack of coordination, lack of communication, and lack of prioritization. And there were times where the family knew his whereabouts more, you know, exactly than the government did. And I guess that people are asking your opinion on it. She said that the whole strategy to eliminate ISIS is going to be to do more bombing. And it was the bombing in Iraq that was the motivation to have them beheading these American journalists. So I guess
These unfortunately are misguided people.
Okay.
There's an old Jewish saying, a half-truth is a full lie. Back it up a bit. You have to go back to 1992-93, when we already knew that we were going to invade Iraq. We had to have regime change in seven different nations, including Libya, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, amongst them. And because we needed an alignment, not just geopolitical alignment, people we could control, much as Egypt was a country that we controlled. It was a subordinate state of ours. And so we knew that we had to have division. We had to balkanize the Middle East. And so we began to fund and train terrorist groups, much as we had done when we trained and funded the Mujahideen, of which Saddam Hussein was one of the members. And we wanted them to create an instability, fear, and tactics. And then you separate out the people. We were fully aware that the people in power and who had control of Iraq, for example, were the Sunnis and the Ba'athist Party. And we also were aware that in order for us to have the people in power we needed to purge the Sunnis from power and put in our people, which we did. Maliki is one of those people, served our interest. And then we signed the treaties to get the oil rights. So during this period of time, once you fund someone and you train them and you arm them and they are inflicting their damage on your behalf, what happens when that conflict morphs into another conflict? Then we go to Libya and we take out Libya through the through NATO, but it was really America, France, and Britain who were doing it. We train them there, and then they're the ones who caused most of the destruction in Libya. Now you have a failed state. You have a fractured state. You've balkanized Libya. So you think that its resources, its water, its oil, other resources can be exploited. What you don't realize is that now you have all these group people who can use what you've given them to then have their own state. And that's where it starts. And then from Libya, they go into Syria. Then you arm them more in Syria. You train them in Lebanon. No, not in Lebanon, in Jordan. You train them in Turkey. And now that is the genesis of ISIS. And so that's what we created. We created it. Now we can't control it. So now the very people that we funded, trained, and organized, we're now going after. Of course, what we didn't do is we didn't bring Iran into it, because Iran, which has a formidable army, would be able to stop ISIS in a heartbeat. But if we bring Iran in, then we have to slow down or turn down our hate campaign against Iran, and that would go against Israel's interest. So we are in this catch-22. Also, if we bring in Iran, Iran would then, by saving Iraq, be the dominant sponsor of Iraq and control its politics. In fact, its two primary defense minister and special forces ministries have not been filled yet. That's Iraq's power. That's Iran's power. So you see, pull back and look at the full state of things, these people would have executed this person irrespective of whether it was Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, or any place else. They're ruled by extremist ideology. We got to go. Thank you, Luann. Let's say hello to Utrice Leet. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Today is Free Your Mind Friday on Leet Stories, and listeners have their say about President Obama's speech on Wednesday.
Great. Utrice Leet right now.